All right, good evening, everybody. We are gonna talk about patience tonight. And so we're in our discipleship class, and we are looking at our last section where we're talking about things that we notice in the life of Jesus that we would want to imitate in our own life. And we've talked about Jesus' motive of pleasing the Father above everything else, the reasons that he came. We looked at a case study in evangelism. Last week we looked at some of his prayers, and tonight we're going to look at the patience that Jesus has with the disciples, which I think should be an encouraging thing for us all to meditate on together. Because when you look at some of the things that the disciples misunderstand about Jesus, and then you find yourself in that same story, but you consider that Jesus stuck with them and didn't just cut them off, it gives us a lot of hope that he'll be with us and he'll teach us the lessons that we need to learn and he won't forsake us. And Matt, your material's probably up there, right? Hebrews 10, 19 through 39? Yeah, okay. So that material's up there. And so starting next week, we're going to be doing our four classes on methods of Bible study. And I'm not going to have the material out until the night of the class because the activities are going to be in class. And so we'll just start talking about those things, Lord willing, next week starting in that class. So, all right, so talking about patience tonight, what I want to do, first of all, is just understand some of the biblical words that the New Testament uses to explain patience and what it is and how to describe it and things like that. And then I want to look at a few instances where Jesus is misunderstood by the disciples and then draw some lessons from how he interacted with them and maybe what they would have learned from him during these interactions. We're not going to look at all of them that are in the material. I think we're just going to highlight a few of them because there's a couple things that I want to do to wrap up at the end if we got time. But let's go ahead and start out with understanding a few things about patience. The word for patience in the Bible appears in three really important lists of godly traits that we need to have. Can anybody tell me some of the big lists of godly traits that are listed out in the New Testament? That we have like names for these passages. Yeah, the fruit of the Spirit. What about another one? Yeah, the love chapter. So you got that one. And then there's another one that is sometimes forgotten, but lists out seven different character qualities, putting on the divine nature. In all three of these passages, the concept of patience is found in it. And there's a couple different Greek words that the New Testament will use that gets translated as patience or steadfastness or long-suffering, things like that. And I just want to put up what some of those words are to get us understanding what we're about to see in the life of Jesus. But the first Greek word is hypomone or something like that, and that oftentimes is translated as steadfastness or patience. And this is made up of two words. The Greek word hypo means to be like under something, and the other word meno means to stay or to remain. What's the picture that you get in your mind of what this word means? Yeah, you're under trial, you're under some kind of duress, and in the midst of that, one way of thinking about it is steadiness in the face of delayed gratification. Like, you're under some kind of burden, and you don't have gratification in the moment, but you're playing the long game, knowing that eventually things are going to get better in some capacity. So that's one way to think about this. The other Greek word is macrothumia. What does micro mean? Small. What's macro? Large or long. So thumos is the Greek word for anger. So this word would mean large anger, which the idea of it is large as in like a long distance. Like anger is far from you, is the idea. You don't have a short fuse, you have a very long fuse. This is going through some kind of suffering without justifying wrath, not paying, repaying evil for evil. I want to come back to that concept in just a moment. But do you guys have any other things you'd add to our understanding of what this word or this concept of patience means? What are some things that we need to be patient with?
Our husbands.
Yeah. I don't have a husband, but all the wives, yes. So you have to be patient with people, right? You have to be patient in circumstances that aren't going the way that you'd want them to go. And so those would maybe be some ways that you can categorize those things. Psychology.com is a website that has a lot of interesting articles about, you guessed it, psychology. And a couple of years ago, there was an article that was written called Crisis U, and it's talking about on the universities in colleges across the United States, the temperament that kids seem to have these days. And in part of this article, it says this: for increasing numbers of students all across the United States, disappointment now balloons into distress and thoughts of suicide. Lacking any means of emotional regulation and generationally bred on the immediacy of having needs met, they know no middle psychic ground. Mere frustration catapults them into crisis. So what Hara Estroff Morano is saying here is that for a lot of people in colleges today, if something doesn't go right in their life, they just get... they like freak out, like the world is going to end, things are really bad. She says here that people today on the college campuses don't have any psychic middle ground. What does psychic middle ground mean, do you think? That's patience.
Being able to find a happy
meaning.
Yeah. Between this and
that. Right. Yeah, you like, because one thing didn't go your way, you do not have to freak out. That's what patience is, that middle psychic kind of ground sort of thing. And what she's saying here is that in our culture today, people are generationally bred on the immediacy of having needs met. So what are the things that in our culture today get met pretty immediately that maybe even 40 years ago were not met immediately? Amazon Prime, what else? The news, we can get it immediately 24/7. What else?
Granger.com.
What was that?
Granger.com.
Granger.com? What's that? Oh, that's who you... so that's a plug for his company. What else? Yeah, fast food. We can get food immediately, and then if we don't have the money to go out to fast food, we can at least get a frozen burrito and put it in the microwave, and it just takes a couple minutes. And so all kinds of things around us are convenient, and those are the small areas in life that used to teach people patience. And so you can start to understand why in our culture we just freak out when something doesn't go our way. So here's a question that I have about this then. How do you know when you've lost patience? This isn't like adultery, like you did the act, you know that that you got the check mark, not in a positive kind of way, but like you did it, right? How do you... patience is something that's kind of like on a spectrum, but what would be some ways to know that you've maybe lost patience with somebody or your circumstance? What was that?
Aggravated.
Yeah, you're getting aggravated and it's coming out in what you're saying. I had another comment. Yeah, you start complaining, which we know that's a sin in the Bible. The Israelites complained 7 times from Numbers 11 to 21, and that's a whole interesting thing to see the connections between what they complained about. So complaining, aggravation, what else? How would you know if you lost patience?
Outburst of wrath.
What else? Kicking things, kicking the dog. Yeah, so there's a whole spectrum of emotions that you can go through. I think one of the ways that you know you've lost patience is when you justify sin because of the difficulty. So anything that would be sinful, you think in the moment is for some reason justified. And then when you look at the life of Jesus, did he have lots of things that would cause you to lose patience? Did he ever lose patience? Okay, so because what we're about to look at, when we look at some of these scenes in the life of Jesus where he is misunderstood by the disciples, there will be times that he rebukes them, which means that you can rebuke somebody, but it doesn't mean that you've lost patience with somebody. So, and I'm not saying that we just have free license to always rebuke people either. That's not the point. But I'm saying that if we start with the premise that Jesus never sinned, and becoming impatient is a sin, all these examples that we have of Jesus, I think, will teach us how to deal with this psychic middle ground more effectively. Any comments or questions about any of that before we start looking at some of these examples of these things? Yeah, Jim? Yeah.
I think that's what Jesus does.
Yeah, you don't sweat the small stuff. You pick your battles.
Just like turning over the money, changing tables. There's a time and place when you really pick that battle.
Right.
You don't pick somebody to death. Just pick.
Right.
You patiently teach them. Just don't sweat that.
Yeah, how many things could Jesus have constantly been correcting in his disciples? Like, everything they did. But do you see him constantly nitpicking them? No, you see him rebuking them, you see him challenging them, but he's not, like, jumping at every single thing that he could have jumped at. Like, he could have been like, hey, why did you just think that thought that you just think? Why did you just think that thought that you just thought? Hey, Peter, why did you do... Thomas, I know that you're doubting again. Like, you don't see him constantly doing that sort of thing. But he knew everything that was in man. But... there's times where he is very much misunderstood, and we're going to see the way he dealt with those things. Any other comments or questions before we start looking at Jim and then Downey?
Patience is also agreeable compromise to be able to find a middle ground for a situation.
Yeah, good. So sometimes patience means that you have to concede something. With Jesus, that's not so much the case because he's always right, but when it comes to us who are imperfect, that's what that would imply. Yeah. Ryan? Yeah, and try to imagine being Jesus then, where you're leaving this mission of changing the world in the hands of 11, because one of them betrayed him, 11 people that are supposed to go out and faithfully dispense the gospel. Not only that, not only are you trying to train these guys, but you're also like having your life threatened at every turn, and Jesus keeps his composure. So let's look at some examples of this. Let's look at, we'll look at this first one. We looked at this passage last week for a different purpose, but I want to see it now from another angle. Look at Mark chapter 1, verses 35 to 39. And this is the first time in the Gospel of Mark that we see the disciples, I think, having a misunderstanding of Jesus, and we see what he does in the midst of this situation. And rising very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said, "Everyone is looking for you." And he said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns, that I might preach there also, for that is why I came out." And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. All right, so this is the first infraction. The disciples come to Peter, they come to Jesus, and they find that he's praying. We talked about this last week. There had been a bunch of people that the day before were getting healed by Jesus, and now they're on the search party trying to find him. They find him, and they say, "All right, Jesus, like, you have to go back because all these people want healing." Do they have a misunderstanding about what Jesus' mission is? Does Jesus fly off the handle? So they fail to understand Jesus' purpose. How does Jesus deal with this potential conflict? Yeah, notice how gentle he is about this. Oh, okay, let's go to the next towns because, hey guys, that's why I came here, was to preach. It wasn't to do all these other things that everybody's expecting of me. And so he redirects them in that way. He explains why he came, and he just corrects them, but not in a super mean kind of way at all. Any other thoughts or comments on this one?
Over the head about it and they feel abundantly guilty.
Right. So yeah, I like the idea that the way that Jesus handles this situation is how we would like to be handled if we misunderstood something. I mean, if I was in this situation and I was Jesus, but I was like a sinful Jesus because I'm not Jesus, like really Jesus, but I'm me with my problems and everything. You know what I mean? If a bunch of people came up to me and I was in the middle of prayer and they were like talking about social gospel stuff, let's go help all these people. That's not our purpose. What's wrong with you guys? Okay, maybe Jesus's way is a little bit better. Like just gently explain and redirect. That's the first example. Do you guys have any other thoughts or comments on that one? That's a good point. Yeah, he's not refuting. Yeah, good. He just focuses on what the purpose is. He doesn't need to dispel all the misunderstandings that they have. That's a good point. All right, we're not going to look at this one, but I'll just say a couple things about this. Mark 4, 35 to 41. In this story, they failed to understand Jesus' power when he calms the storm. He's sleeping on the boat, and they wake him up and they say, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" And then Jesus tells the storm to just quit it, and then it does, and they're shocked. And so Jesus in that story rebukes them, or he challenges them on their faith. So similar kind of thing where he's explaining to them, like, hey, like, where is your guys' faith in the midst of this situation? Maybe a little bit more ramped up from what we saw in the first story. But I want to go to another story in the Gospel of Mark that maybe has some of those same ideas, but in a heightened kind of way. In the Gospel of Mark, there are three stories where Jesus is on a boat with the disciples. The first one is in Mark 4, where he calms the storm there. The second one is in Mark 6, where he walks on water. This is the third one in Mark chapter 8, verses 14 through 21. But as I read this text, try to think about the questions. What is it that they're not understanding about Jesus, and how does Jesus challenge them or redirect them or help them along in their misunderstanding? Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, "Watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 12. "And the seven for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, "Do you not yet understand?" All right, what don't they understand here? Okay, good. Good. So for those who didn't hear Matt's comment, they're misunderstanding physical versus spiritual. They're still thinking in a physical kind of terminology here. What else would you guys say about what they're misunderstanding here?
His providence, like his ability to provide in situations of need.
Yeah, good. So Ben just said they're failing to misunderstand Jesus' providence and his ability to take care of them. This whole section begins with Jesus warning them about what? The leaven of the Pharisees, which is their hypocrisy, their false teaching, their ungodly attitudes, kind of the influence that they could have on people. How many loaves of bread do they have with them in the boat? One. So here's how I picture what's happening. They get in the boat, and Jesus has, you know, already proven, in fact, one of the stories right before this, he just multiplies a bunch of bread. I guess they didn't bring all of it with them, or they left some of it or something. And they're in the boat with one loaf, and Jesus looks at them and says, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees." And I wonder if they all turn and look at that one loaf of bread and go, "What did they put in that bread?" The Pharisees must have put some kind of poison or something in it. I don't know. I don't know how else to understand that. There's probably some better way to think about what's happening there. But they start discussing with one another the fact that they have no bread. We don't have what we need. Jesus has already proven that he can multiply bread. He's already proven that he can provide for them. And then they're squabbling about the fact that they have no bread. And Jesus' comment about the leaven is just making them think about physical things. And so they are misunderstanding his providence. They're misunderstanding the spiritual versus physical. By this point, Jesus should be able to make a physical comment, and then they should have the eyes to see the spiritual meaning behind it. Can you imagine being Jesus, and you've been preaching, even in when you compare this with the Gospel of John, Jesus has already multiplied bread 2 times, and the first time he did it, the crowd came back asking for more bread, and Jesus says, you guys missed the purpose or the sign to everything that I was doing. You're misunderstanding me. And now his disciples are misunderstanding some of these things as well. I would be pretty frustrated. How does Jesus handle this moment? Bless you, by the way. Right, yeah, he's very gentle. Like, if they were my kids, I don't know that I would handle them with that much patience. Was there somebody else saying something? Yeah, he does challenge them, though, here, right? So, do you notice the slew of questions he asks? Why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? All of these are questions, question after question after question. And after he gives those lists of questions, he asks them, do you remember the first time that we fed the 5,000? How much was left over? What's the answer? 12. He's making them recite what he's done. How many baskets were left over, guys? And all 12 men say 12. And then the second time that we did this, how many baskets were left over? 7. Like, do they know Bible facts? Do they know facts about the Bible and like the works that Jesus has done? Yeah, they know those things, but what Jesus is doing is getting them to meditate and think deeper about the things they already know. They already had the knowledge within them that should have been digested so that they would understand that Jesus can provide for them the things that they need. They intellectually knew what they already needed to know. But what they needed to do is digest what they already knew. And so, like, from Jesus' perspective, it's like, guys, you know this. You just haven't thought deeply enough about it. And I multiplied bread 2 times. Like, those were pretty big miracles. Like, didn't you get it? Yeah. I mean, like, what if I preached a sermon, like 2 sermons in a row that were part of the same series, and you guys didn't understand what I was talking about, and of course it wouldn't be my fault. It'd be your fault to not understand it, right? No, it wouldn't, by the way. So they're failing to understand the spiritual meaning of all of this. And the way that Jesus deals with this, besides asking all these questions, he's getting them to recite the works that he's done. Can you see how that might be helpful in dealing with people? What was that? Yeah, especially to a group that's so often forgot everything that he's done or not really thought about it enough. I don't know, you guys have any thoughts about how Jesus handles this moment? Is he becoming impatient here? No, because he didn't sin, right? But is he still challenging them? Yeah, but he's not doing it with anger or bitterness or anything like that. Any other thoughts on this one? Yeah. Yeah, don't you get it? You know, like, you should know by now. And I don't think he's just like slamming the boat and hitting it, like, come on, like, nothing like that. But he is challenging them. Matt?
Spoiler alert, next Sunday, or this coming Sunday, chapter 10 in Hebrews, he reminds them of all the things that they had previously done, persevered through, plundering of the property.
Yeah, good. Yes.
It's reminding them of previous past spiritual success to kind of persevere and continue through that.
Good. So in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 32 to 35, the writer of Hebrews brings up the suffering that they've already gone through, and he said, don't throw away your confidence. Like, look at what you've already been through. Debbie? Yeah.
But he didn't. He took every opportunity to teach. And I think his parents, especially me on this side looking back, there's so many opportunities when he gets his parents to teach those important lessons that Jesus is showing us how to do it. Instead of getting impatient, it's an opportunity to teach.
Yes, this is one of the big takeaways that I've been thinking about as I've been thinking about this lesson, is all the moments that you'd be most tempted to fly off the handle. Okay, maybe your judgment about the matter is right. And maybe the more right you are, the more frustrated you might be. But if you just stop for a second and think about the way Jesus dealt with being misunderstood or people being knuckleheads around him, they were opportunities to teach rather than inflict pain on others because you're feeling pain right now. There's a couple of hands. David, and then did you have something too, Nick? I'll get to you next. Yes.
And here, by his ability to take these things that are leftovers and create mold, he has power over all these physical things. It would really be a dent in his credibility if he had power and control over those things, but lacked power and control over himself.
That's right. Yeah. You know, and that's an interesting point to, like, just theologically in the Bible, big picture of the Bible. What was Adam and Eve supposed to have dominion over? What was mankind supposed to have dominion over? The world, right? Creation. In Genesis 4, when God counsels Cain about his sin and his anger towards his brother, he says that sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, as if it's like this animal that you've got to rule over. Because as a human being, you've been made with that dignity and that power to rule over things. Not only the animals, but the animal within you, which is your sin. And then eventually, here comes Jesus, who in Daniel chapter 7 is called one like the Son of Man. But at the beginning of Daniel 7, there's these four giant earth beasts representing four different nations. And then you see these giant, intimidating composite creatures, and you pan over and you see one like the Son of Man coming from the throne of heaven and then having subduing all of these nations. Like, Jesus is the perfect man who finally had authority over everything. And I think one of the ways that the Gospels show you that Jesus is the perfect man is by his dominion over the world, like telling a storm to quit it. It's a hyperbolic, it's an emphasized way of saying he's the perfect man. But that's a whole different point. Did you have your hand up, though, Matt, before? No, you didn't. Okay, Nick? Well, we're supposed to have dominion over the horses, so beat it. Right. 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 Yeah, like if somebody's getting, if somebody's misunderstanding you, like, would it be appropriate to say, when have I ever given you that impression? When have I ever treated you in this way? Has that ever happened? No. Okay, then, like, that's not my track record with you. So do you not understand that what you're thinking about me is not right? Like, it's okay to challenge in a loving way. That's kind of what Jesus is doing here. Now, he doesn't do that every time, but he does do it on occasion. Yeah, Courtney? Yeah, good. Yeah, good. So Courtney was saying that Jesus, when he's interacting with these people, he knows that they're flawed human beings, but I think what he's doing is he's pushing them towards their potential. And that's something that he's always, like the first time he meets Peter, what's Peter's name originally? Simon. In John chapter 1, when Jesus first meets Peter, he's just like introducing himself to him, and Jesus just goes, "Oh, you're Peter. I'll call you Peter." Can you imagine, like, when I was first meeting you guys, if I just started renaming you? Jesus, by the way, historically invented the name Peter. There's no written records of anybody named Peter before John chapter 1. But his name then means rock. Does Peter seem like a rock? Maybe the only time is when he started sinking in the water. But like rock is something that's dependable, reliable, like God is my rock and my refuge, my strength, all that kind of thing. Peter doesn't seem like a strong kind of person in that sense. But Jesus names him in such a way that he sees what he can become. And that's what he sees in people. That's what he's seeing in the disciples. But he needs to shake these things out of them so that they can have the right understanding. All right, so there's a lot of things that we could say about a lot of these. I want to move on to the next one. Mark 9, 33 through 37, or Mark 10, 13 through 16. We'll just look at one of these two. Look at Mark 9. In both of these stories, the disciples are failing to understand Jesus's care and concern for children. Look at 9:33. And they came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you discussing on the way?" But they kept silent. For on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all." And he took a child and put him in the midst of them. And taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me." All right, if I'm Jesus here, I'm getting really mad. Jesus has already started saying, "I'm going to give up my life. The Son of Man has come to serve." He's going to be more explicit about that in chapter 10. But his example all the way through has been service, 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 humiliation, being humbled. He's counted among the transgressors. He's hanging out with tax collectors and sinners. And then on their way towards his crucifixion to get to Jerusalem, they're like hanging out in the back while Jesus is maybe in the front. And they're like, "Hey, like Peter, James, and John, like, we know that we're at least in the top three because Jesus hangs out with us the most. Plus, you guys couldn't cast out that demon at the base of the mountain just like a few verses ago, remember? Because they probably referenced verses like that. You guys couldn't cast out the demon, but we saw something really cool up on this mount of something that I can't tell you, transfiguration. We can't tell you about what we've seen." Like, it's clearly Peter, James, and John that are amongst the best. So amongst those three, like, I don't know how they're arguing about all these things, but Jesus' example has had nothing to do with greatness. So Jesus asks this question, "What were you guys talking about?" By the way, if Jesus just like popped in like a room you were in one day, and like, "Hey, what were you just talking about?" Would that intimidate you? Jesus is challenging them on this, and what is it that they're failing to understand? What was that? All souls are equal. He uses the child to teach him that. And so you're trying to be the greatest. And when you don't realize that everybody is equally valuable, and greatness means what? Service. How does Jesus teach them here? He uses a child. Like, this would be the last moment of my life that I would ever want to be holding a kid. Because, like, if I'm holding, like, a stress ball, like, that thing's going to break in half. Like, I'm getting closer and closer to my death. You guys are still not getting here. You're arguing about which of... Even in Luke's account, when Jesus is doing the Lord's Supper, they're still arguing about which of them is the greatest. And then in John's account, he gets down and he washes their feet, I think as a lesson to teach them that they shouldn't be focusing on those kinds of things. So they're repeatedly arguing about these matters. And then how much patience would it take to hold a child, say, "Guys, here's an object lesson for you. Greatness means that you're willing to serve and help children." Like this object lesson, like there's things all around you that you can teach people lessons with, and he just grabs this baby and here it is, and it's like got drool coming out of its mouth and stuff. You want to hold this thing? I don't think so, but that you would if you were great. Any other comments or questions on that one? All right, look at this next one, Mark 14. In Mark 14, 27 to 31, speaking of the Lord's Supper, Mark 14, 27 to 31. And Jesus said to them, "You will all fall away, for it is written, 'I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. And after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.' Peter said to him, 'Even though they all fall away, I will not.' And Jesus said to him, 'Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will not deny me three times.' But he said emphatically, 'If I must die with you, I will not deny you.' And they all said the same." All right. What are they not understanding here? Yeah. Not only is he making a prediction that they're going to fall away, is there biblical precedent that they will? Does he quote any Bible passage here? Zechariah, right? If you strike the shepherd, the sheep will scatter. So he goes, okay, guys, there's a passage in Zechariah that's about to be fulfilled. The Bible says you will fall away in this moment. I am God, and I'm telling you, you will also fall away. And then Peter goes, no, I won't. Like, this is just direct defiance. And if I have scripture backing me up and I can also perfectly see into the future and somebody goes, no, I don't think so. Oh, okay, now it's time for a spanking. So Peter is challenged, he just doesn't listen to anything Jesus is saying here. How does Jesus handle this one? Yes. Yeah. I wonder if Jesus is thinking, like you said, about the emotions Peter's about to go through. Like, he's going to weep when Jesus looks at him in Luke's account. He looks at him after he's denied him, and then he breaks down weeping. The way that Jesus handles this is he just repeats what he said. Now, he says, like, there's going to be this rooster. By the way, what's the job of a rooster? It wakes people up in the morning, right? And this rooster is going to wake him up spiritually. So it's kind of fitting that it would be a rooster that would do this. And so after the rooster, he says, like, he even, like, adds more detail. There's going to be a rooster. It's going to, like, be over to your side. And it's going to, like, make its sounds a couple times. And then you'll know. But he just gently repeats what he said. Can you imagine the stress? He just did the Lord's Supper. And talked about how he's going to die, and Judas is about to come and betray him, and there's going to be the Garden of Gethsemane moment, and there's going to be the trials. He knows everything that's going on, and he's not using his circumstances as an excuse to just fly off the handle and just sneeze and kill all of them. So, I don't know, do you guys all feel challenged by Jesus' example here? It's amazing the composure. And all the sins that everybody's ever committed were all against him. And he's in every room he's filled with is filled with people that have all their sins have ultimately been against him. Yeah, Ben, because he's God.
So Jesus reemphasizes his point, but then Peter comes back again and reemphasizes the fact that he's not going to betray Jesus.
Yes.
Right,
all the disciples are in on this. They're like, yeah, we're all good, Jesus. Don't worry about us.
So I think it's almost more impressive that he holds it together after that incident.
That's good, yeah.
Where he repeats himself, you know, because we wouldn't like that, having to repeat ourselves and then they double down.
Right, like for us, like when our child, if we say, like, Asher, get your shoes on. No, he hasn't said anything like that for a long time. But if I say, like, no, get your shoes, no. Okay, like, it's time for corporal punishment. When you get direct defiance like that. And so, yeah, you and then you.
I know we're focusing on the patience part, but I think it's also a really good instance of Jesus. Like, he's still teaching, like, even up to the last point. Because he knows that
yes.
If he keeps pushing this,
through his mistake is going to, like, sear that into his brain better than anything Jesus could say.
Yep. Good. Good. David? Yep. Is yeah, he's explaining to Peter what you're going to do, no malice, no sinful anger in his heart as he says it. Amazing. And by the way, is Jesus masculine? Was he a masculine guy? How much in our society do we think being a man means like punching walls and kicking dogs and like breaking glass bottles and fighting people? Like, that is not masculinity. Look at how patient, part of being a human being made in God's image is to have patience. David, are you going to say something?
Well, Jesus knew how Peter was going to react. I mean, he knew what Peter was going to do. But if he couldn't help Peter to understand what was going to take place shortly, he wanted him to, he's building a huge foundation upon which Peter is going to base his faith.
Yeah.
The kingdom, or the propagation of the kingdom, really would depend on these 12 men.
Yep. Yep.
And so he's concerned that probably more than anything else, what kind of foundations is Peter going to have to do the work that I'm going.
Yeah. Yeah, good. Well, and as you think about this character quality of Jesus, again, what we're doing is we're thinking about discipleship. Are the disciples watching Jesus handle things like this? And they're going, okay, I signed up to follow this guy. I signed up to be like this guy. And every time I would have flown off the handle, he uses it as a teaching opportunity. He does it with love. There's no malice in his heart. I need to be more like that. We don't have time to look at the last one in Mark 16, but I do leave us with these questions. What do you learn from Jesus' example? We've already been talking about all that, but think about this question. What impact have patient, I had a bad spelling there, be patient with me. What impact have patient people had on your life? You think about like people that have been there for you and didn't fly off the handle every time you made a mistake, all those sorts of things. Those people changed your life. Can you imagine being with Jesus where there's all kinds of times where he would have had the right to just throw you off to the side and he didn't do it? Those people changed the world. The apostles did. Any other final comments or thoughts or questions or anything about any of this?
We can see that when Jesus talks about Peter's falling away, he says his peace and he leaves it at that. He doesn't add any more to it.
Right. Yeah, the one about the disciples denying that they will deny Jesus, who gets the last word in the text in verse 31? The disciples do. No, we won't. Okay. I've said what I wanted to say, and I'm God.
It's a lesson in humility.
Yes. Right.
Actually, I think taking their ego down a few notches so that they were more humble from that point forward.
Right.
It had to be devastating. We were only told of Peter, but I'm sure all of the apostles, this affected them the same way that it did Peter, because they all denied him.
Right. And after the fact, they would know Jesus is right.
No, he told us this would happen.
Yep. Right. Good. Good. Ben?
Just think for us, our takeaway is that if we're not patient with our fellow man, then they might not get the opportunity to learn the lesson.
Very significant point here. Ben is saying that if we fail to be patient with other people, we are hindering them from growing. Thanks for your good comments. If you guys liked this class was Samantha's idea. The bad classes were my ideas. Samantha was like, yeah, you should do one on how Jesus showed patience with the disciples. So there you go, Samantha. All right, guys, thank you.